Is breaking good or bad for the hobby? Let's talk about it on today's Cards on the Table. Hello! that's a lot harder than it looks. Hello, sports card investors. I'm Doug, the Director of Community Partnerships. With me today, no Jeff, he's in New York City, and we can't find Teapot, so I've got Hammer. He is a content specialist for Sports Card Investor and making his debut, and maybe his last appearance, Ben Burrows.
Probably.
Ben is our content director, and he's the brains behind a lot of what you see on this channel and our other channels. Thanks for joining me today, guys. How are you?
Very well, very well. Great to have both of you on.
Pleasure to be here. Obviously scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Naturally. So one of the things we want to talk about today, we're going to lead it right off, is breaking good or bad for the hobby. Now, last week, I mentioned, as we were talking about wax prices, that breakers kind of keep wax prices afloat because they're going to naturally buy every new release as it comes out in order to have that product available for their customers. And no matter what the prices are set to, they are kind of locked in if they want to keep their business going. So how much do breakers impact wax prices? Do we think that they're good representatives of the hobby? Ben, do you have some thoughts on this?
So in terms of wax prices, I really think they have a lot less impact than what people think. Breaking, I know a lot of people are relatively new to the hobby. Breaking is not new to the hobby. It's been around for decades. People have been doing this for years and years and years. When card prices holistically were low, they were low for breakers. Now they're holistically high in a lot of instances, so they're high for breakers. I think there's a lot less of it to do with breakers specifically and more just as the hobby as a whole. And in general, I think, you know, breakers are probably pretty good. I think the community that they build is really good. You know, somebody like you, Doug, when you post a break in your Discord, mm-hmm. it fills up pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think that is overall a net positive for the hobby, even though some, you know, we won't mention any names, some seem a little shady, or, you know, some breakers aren't necessarily great ambassadors for the hobby. Overall, I think it is really good, and it's going to be one of the things that really carries us past. Probably, you know, people talk about a junk wax era or something like that. I think the communities that we have with breaking are really going to help keep pushing the hobby forward.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things you just said that I really love is the community aspect of it, right? You know, I do every, when I was a full-time breaker, it was strictly through the Sports Card Investor Discord. I wasn't, a large-scale breaker by any means. But there is a very real sense of community. You get to have that interaction live with the people that are buying into your breaks. You get to know each other. I've been able to meet a lot of them at card shows. And that's a very real connection and something that's one of my favorite parts of the hobby, to be honest. Hammer, give me your thoughts on breakers, good or bad for the hobby.
So yeah, I think it's overall, it's a good thing. Like you said, it's been around for a while. I love the fact that it is very community driven and it makes collectors feel like, you know, they're brothers and sisters in that regard. So I loved that, seeing that sort of that part of the hobby continue to grow. I also think it's great for people to have the opportunity to be able to maybe pull that big card from a break that they normally wouldn't be able to buy into. And somebody who typically doesn't do too much breaks, I'm somebody who enjoys doing Bowman breaks. I can just get, you know, go my favorite team, the St. Louis Cardinals, get them in a break, get all of the prospects that I want. So there's a lot of advantages when it does come to breaking that I enjoy. However, there are some cons. Like, you know, I think it is one of the biggest gambling aspects of sports cards. So I do think it's something that people need to be careful of, that they don't necessarily get caught too much into it. Because majority of the time, you're not going to get your return when you do decide to get into these breaks.
But would you argue it's less of a gamble than buying an entire box for yourself?
I would go that far to say yes, it's definitely less of a gamble. But I would also say I'm more of a traditional collector who wants to actually have the packs in hand to open myself. Now that's where there might be some difference, and I understand the entertainment value of still being able to watch your cards get pulled. And the only other thing I would end off in is, yeah, you know, with the amount of, you know, the hobby's grown recently, you're getting more and more new breakers. So just make sure you're doing your research to make sure that they have a decent track record so you're not just dealing with any dishonesty. Yeah. And then you know, you basically sum that up as how the whole hobby is. Because it's not like that. There's some really good breakers out there, just like yourself, that are really good for this community.
Yeah, you make a really good point there. As the card space has grown, breakers they're a dime a dozen now, honestly. You know, I can say that because I'm one of them. There's so many breakers out there. It's inevitable. I mean, there's just so much money in this space, and there's so much money to be made within breaking. It's inevitable that a lot of people are going to flock to that, and it's inevitable that there's going to be some bad actors involved here and there. It is a part of finding someone that you trust, someone that you can relate to, someone that you enjoy buying into their breaks. It's not solely about the cars itself. There's a lot of pros that go into that, you know. I mean, it's obvious, right? One of the reasons we're buying into breaks is because you can search for a specific team, search for a specific player or a specific card without having to buy an entire box. You can even get involved in case breaks, and that'll let you, you know, go across many, many boxes without, you know, having to come out of pocket for an entire case yourself. So, you know, while I kind of phrased that last week as potentially negative as far as wax prices are concerned, obviously overall I think that breakers are a positive, a net positive for the community, and I hope that, you know, we can all agree on that at least. Moving on into another topic, normally this is where we would talk about Data Dive, but again, Teapot has gone missing, so I don't know what to do about this. I think what we'll talk about instead is some recent PSA news. I feel like we talk about grading companies almost every week, but there's usually something to talk about almost every week. So recently, PSA announced that they are no longer going to have the lottery events for the economy service. They have opened up economy service to their members without any limitations and without any vouchers required. Ben, I think you might have some thoughts on this. We've talked about this off camera a little bit. How do you feel about the fact that PSA has just kind of unleashed the floodgates on economy service?
So I will say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Okay.
Obviously, it's nice to see that they feel confident enough to take on an unlimited number of cards. But I will say I was a huge fan of the queue system, you know, the weekly lottery, stuff like that. I think that that needs to be something that they probably need to bring back. We keep talking about, we were wondering, what is this going to be? Is it, you know, a $25 value that
right.
they're going to announce? If that's something that they bring back, I think they really seriously have to consider bringing back that type of queue system.
I would assume they will, yeah.
Or keep it to like collectors club members or something mm-hmm. like that. If they don't, I think we're going to be in a very similar situation to what we were a couple years ago. People, myself included, are sitting on hundreds of cards that they would love to submit at that $25 tier or something
yes.
like that. And so millions upon millions of cards are going to be coming in. And I think it could be even worse because there's how many people got into the hobby mm-hmm. in 2020 or so and didn't submit cards because PSA was already
exactly.
backed up. How many of those people are already sitting on those cards? So I'm cautiously optimistic,
okay.
but really want to see that type of queue system come back if PSA moves on to a lower price point.
I would certainly agree that if they bring back value sometime soon at $25 per submission, that a queue system would really help out a lot. I am glad that they've kept these economy submissions to collectors club mm-hmm. members right now.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people bought the Collectors Club yearly subscription just to be a part of this lottery event. They've taken that away rather quickly, so I'm glad this is still kind of exclusive to them. It'll also help limit just how many people dive into this. What do you think, Hammer? Is this the right way to do things as far as opening up economy, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, in terms of the news, I thought it was a bit underwhelming. I was actually hoping for that $25 entry fee. So to me, it just, you know, it wasn't what I expected. So in terms of competition for PSA, I don't think it really moves the needle much
right.
in that regard. And, you know, as somebody who still has cards sitting at PSA, it's not the greatest feeling to see that they're opening the floodgates when I'm still waiting for my cards
back. That's the big con, right?
So that's kind of where I'm at with it. But I'm always happy to see progress in terms of them being able to start opening up more submissions and things like that. Because like you said, people have just been sitting on cards and wanting to send in the PSA. And maybe this announcement now may sway them now to get that process started.
I think he hit on probably the biggest negative that everyone is thinking about right now is that PSA still has a pretty substantial backlog. And we also know now that they're taking on the responsibility of eBay's authenticity guarantee for slabs.
That's right.
So we're going to open up the floodgates on economy. We still have a pretty big backlog, and we're going to take some of our staff and put them on eBay's authenticity guarantee. What is this going to do to turnaround times, and is this fair to people that have cards in the backlog? How would you feel about that? I mean, I'm one of them.
Yeah, I mean, so I sort of sympathize with PSA to a certain extent. That's been a huge argument mm-hmm. of there's a lot of collectors out there that say until the backlog is completely done, you shouldn't grade any new cards.
Yeah.
But the way that I look at it too is, one, they have a huge amount of people dedicated to that backlog, And I think you can only grade so many cards in a day. You don't want to overload stuff like that. A huge number of those cards are ultra-modern base cards
yes.
that you probably shouldn't dedicate like a massive number of resources to. And I think it's easy to say, oh, just shut down your business until, shut down your business until you finish this backlog.
Yeah.
I think there's a middle ground here where they can take on new submissions, continue to cut through the backlog. And I don't know if you guys follow Gymrate. They post, yes. Ryan with Gymrate posts how many cards PSA is grading on like a weekly or a monthly basis. Hundreds of thousands of cards more. We're talking like PSA in a month is grading 800,000 cards and BGS is grading like 10,000 cards.
Exactly.
The volume is huge, absolutely huge. I think they're trying to do their best.
So what you're saying is be patient. You're going to get those base Prism Jarrett Culvers and Goga Batatsis back any day now. Next up, we're going to dive into our mailbag segment and answer questions from you. But first, we're going to take a quick break. If you want to try Market Movers, download it today and use code 7FREE. That's the number 7, the word free, for 7 free days of Market Movers. Up next, we're going to jump into the mailbag, answer questions from you. I want to remind you, please leave your questions in the comments and we might answer them on a future episode. First things first, we're going to talk about prospecting in baseball. That's not something I'm extremely well versed in. When I have questions about prospecting in baseball, I go to my man Hammer. So Hammer, talk to me. Prospecting in baseball, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so usually you have to go with starting with, what players you necessarily want to go after, or who are the desired players. So using Baseball America, MILB, going to their top 100 prospects list is a great way to start to see what potentially players that you would want to potentially go after. I also like to go a step further by using something called the 20 to 80 scouting scale, and that's where they give you certain attributes like power, arm strength, that are in between those 20 to 80 ranges, which is specific to baseball, which can give you an idea sort of, what kind of power do they have? Are they going to be somebody that looks like they're projected to have Aaron Judge type of power? So you can really get into the nitty gritty in terms of seeing maybe what a potential prospect's strengths are or what their weaknesses are and what they need to work on. So that's generally the first thing I like to do. Once we get more into the card aspect of things.
Yeah, is there a certain brand or anything that you would go for?
Yeah, so you typically, what you're going to deal with is the two main factors are going to be the player and the set. So we already talked a bit about the player. So once you find the player, the typical set that you're going to go with is Bowman. Now, there's usually a big three. There's regular Bowman that was just released recently. You have Bowman Draft. You also have Bowman Chrome. You also have new subsets like Sapphire as well for these three. But those are the three big boys that you're basically going to be going after to be able to find what prospect in particular you want. Now, what I like to do is to religiously follow and read the checklist. That's how you're going to know who is going to have their first in what particular set. You're going to know if they're going to have a autograph Bowman first or if they're going to just have a regular first. So those are the things that I usually like to do when sort of deciding what player do I want to go after, do I want to go after the top guys or do I want to sort of go after bargain basement guys? So that's essentially how I go about doing it. The last thing I would say is baseball prospecting is considered one of the most volatile, markets within the hobby. So knowing when to sell is really almost as important as who the player is. I know some people like to think about cards from a long-term aspect, but in many scenarios, these players like Wander Franco, Bobby Witt Jr., they're getting moved or sold, as they're getting called up. So some, collectors don't have to deal with how are these guys going to vote in the major leagues or if they're going to be somebody that's going to be one of the best of all time. Just because they make it to the big leagues doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be the best of all time.
That sounds really complicated with all the different stats that you have to break down. I prefer my method of prospecting, which is just where I watch a game and say, that guy's a bum, or he's not a bum. Ben, he's talking about Bowman, and before we move on to the next topic, Bowman kind of strikes with me because there's Bowman U now out, and it's for football currently, and I'm sure they'll do the same thing for basketball. Is there any point in prospecting with Bowman U for other sports outside of baseball?
I don't think so. Yeah. Obviously, they're unlicensed products. There's something that I particularly wouldn't dabble in. Mm-hmm. I know you and I both have like strong connections to college teams, mm-hmm. and I think those are targeted toward those a little bit, but we know in the investing community that college jerseys aren't super sought after. So if you're
Yeah, it's kind of a weird spot for that product, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's not super investable, but as a collector of, say, University of Kentucky athletes, yeah. it's completely wiped away from the jersey, and it's stripped down to just the color blue. So for me, it doesn't really scratch that itch either.
Exactly. You know, I'm always looking for my Syracuse guys, and yeah. I do buy them in Syracuse jerseys.
Sure.
But this, like you said, doesn't really scratch the itch either way. They're not in their Syracuse gear. I don't want to look at them, even if I wanted to sell them down the line. I wouldn't look at these as being investable cards. If it's strictly for your PC, go ahead. You know,
sure.
I'm a big proponent of if it's for your PC, buy whatever you want, whenever you want, for as much as you want, and just be happy about it. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
Sure.
But for something like that, from an investment standpoint, I would stay clear.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that it does have going for it is it's a pretty affordable chase, so it's probably an easy way to get into one of your favorite upcoming players without waiting for one of the big releases where it's going to cost 10x. We are way over time on that topic. Ben talked forever. I guess he doesn't really understand how this all goes yet.
That was my bad.
But moving on to our last mailbag topic for today, we want to talk about the correlation between card prices and championships. Currently, are card prices affected appropriately based on championship level performance? And, you know, Hammer, this is something that we've been talking about lately with Embiid a little bit. You know, MVP caliber player, does he need a ring in order to, you know, sustain prices? What do you think about this?
Yeah, so what I think is, championships are going to contribute more to a player's long-term value than it's going to be immediate value. An example that I could give firsthand is Matthew Stafford. This was a guy I was buying last year before the season. They won the Super Bowl. His cards were going for less than they were before the season. So I think that's a scenario where he's going to have to keep playing, and just over time, he's going to be more appreciated because of that Super Bowl. But if you even look, you know, in different generations, a guy like Dan Marino was one of the best of his generation, you know, and as a guy who didn't end up winning a Super Bowl ring. And if you look at, you know, the tops PSA 10 rookies of him and John Elway, John Elway goes for about twice as much. Why? Because he has a Super Bowl ring.
Sure.
So that's where I'm at with it as of right now.
Yeah, and that's a good point. How long has Stafford been in the league? How many seasons? 10?
I think 2009 is his rookie, so okay. So he's been in the league over 10 years.
So for the first decade of his career, was he suddenly just not a championship-worthy quarterback, and all of a sudden he was just 1 year later? I mean, it's just a factor of him switching to a team that was built better around him to earn a championship. So in that sense, I don't really see how that should have that much of an impact on his cards. You know, he was the same caliber of quarterback. He just got on a better team that was better suited to make it that far, right?
Yeah, I do think that's a good point, and that's where I would argue that sports, it's a team game, you know, and the Lions aren't very good.
Sure.
I couldn't tell you the last investable player outside of Barry Sanders, and I think there's a reason for that. So I do think some of it, that's another guy who decided, I'm out of here early because I'm tired of getting killed, even though Matty Stafford's the one who's throwing me the ball. Now, the story isn't written yet. So, and that's where I brought something up like Elway and Marino,
sure.
where that's at least you're able to zoom out a little bit because those guys are no longer playing. So I do think you have a point, though, with guys that are currently playing, there is something to be said about that immediate value.
Yeah. So we're talking championships right now, and unfortunately, Ben can't really weigh in. He's a Syracuse fan, doesn't know a ton about championships. But if you have any way of contributing, go for it.
I don't know if I want to anymore.
Okay.
But I will say that I did look at some card prices, and I think it's an interesting discussion because I think it's sort of going in two weird ways here. So I think a lot of the collecting community and just general fans being more savvy have started to decide that maybe a championship isn't the end-all be-all, and I think Giannis was a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Leading up in 2021, leading up to the title, his prices floated between, like, on his 2013 Prism Base PSA 10,
mm-hmm.
between like $1,500 and $3,000. It trickled down a little bit. Then when he won the title, bumped back up, then immediately fell off again
sure.
after the season, which is normal.
Yes.
But I think a lot of people looked at Giannis and said, okay, objectively, you have to look at him and say, over the next 15 years, if he keeps this up, or the next 5 or 10 years, whatever it is, he will be one of the greatest players of all time.
Mm-hmm.
It is sort of a technicality whether or not he wins a title. Should that really impact him? But on the other hand, I think it's sort of negatively affecting some of those prices because if Giannis doesn't win a title, is his base prism a $3,000 card? And then we start to compare that to vintage baseball or you know, sets
yeah.
like that where you're starting to look at, you know, Jason Dominguez, we talked about months ago on the show, you're starting to have to get to all-time great levels to warrant some of these prices. And if Giannis doesn't reach that, without a title, is a $3,000 Prism actually worth it? So it's like sort of happening in this weird paradox sort of thing.
Yes. I think it's also important to recognize that not all champions are created equal. Why aren't Bill Russell or Robert Horry's cards the most expensive cards on the market if that's your qualifier?
Yeah.
And I also don't think it's fair to, you know, championship or put championship or bust expectations in a team setting.
Sure.
Football, where you've got 11 guys on one side of the field, or basketball, where it's, you know, five guys on the field, maybe more important for individual sports, but when it comes to team sports, there's a lot of other factors that weigh into whether or not someone's going to win that championship.
Yeah.
Regardless, that's all the time we've got for today. I want to thank everybody for watching this episode. Please remember to leave your questions in the comments, and please tune in next Thursday for another episode of Cards on the Table.